You're listening to Giles Brown on TRE Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain. A Genesis in My Bed, Steve Hackett, the autobiography. July sees the publication of A Genesis in My Bed, a book that is overdue, from guitar great and former member of Genesis, Steve Hackett. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from somewhere in the UK. Steve himself. Steve, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon to you. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Whereabouts are you, by the way, in
I'm in Teddington. Of course, it's 2 hours earlier here, I think, so, or at least 1 hour. It's sort of near 11 o'clock here. So we're in the old country. It's Teddington.
Marvellous part of the world. I hear that you only just made it back before the lockdown, by the way. You were on tour.
Yeah, we were on tour in America, and then America literally closed down when we were halfway through the tour, and we got the last flight back from Philadelphia, so... And then we're in lockdown ourselves, but I've been busy recording. So even though I can't tour at the moment, it's a productive period in other ways.
So, I mean, people have had some time on their hands to reflect and regurgitate on what's been going on. It's sort of, it's a bit of a lucky accident, I suppose, that the book was coming out, you know, at the same time. Why did you decide that the time was right, you know, at the beginning of this year or the end of last year to start, you know, putting all this down?
Yeah, well, basically the book was done just before we went off on tour in America, so most of it was put together over the last couple of years, but of course the gestation period was much longer than that. We had that ready, luckily, or else, you know, there'll be further difficulties, so I've been signing them. I mean, although there won't be any sort of personal appearances because of... the COVID crisis and all the rest that everyone's sick of hearing about. I am signing masses of these books, and it's already into a second run because they've already sold out. So I'm very happy about that, and let's hope it keeps going.
So what was it like then to go back and revisit those days? And tell me a little bit about how you actually got involved with Genesis.
Well, it was great fun going back and revisiting the past. The 1950s that I grew up in London, when it was a very smog-ridden, smoky old place post-war, with lots of bomb sites and buildings that were falling to pieces, and in the heart of London, opposite the Battersea Power Station, made famous later, some 20 years afterwards, by Pink Floyd, of course, with the flying pig in front of it. But that was my bedroom window scene. That's what I saw as a child, and I was always fascinated by it. Jump ahead a few years to joining Genesis. I used to advertise ever since I was 16. I left school at 16, for about 5 years, every week I used to advertise in the back pages of Melody Maker, which was the all-important trade paper. At the time, it was the most popular, and lots of British bands were formed off the back pages. It was just the way it was. Peter Gabriel phoned me up. I had this very wordy ad in there. First of all, I was advertising myself as blues guitarist, harmonica player, seeks work, and then it gradually morphed over the years to guitarist, writer, seeks receptive musicians determined to strive beyond existing stagnant music forms.
Right.
So, you know, and that was it. So that's what really got me the call from Peter Gabriel. And he said, we have this band called Genesis. Have you ever heard of us? And I said, no, but I'll give you a listen. And then I joined them. And that was it.
And what was it like then, working, you know, walking in for the first time on the first day in the studio? I mean, was it a studio gig to begin with, or did you go on tour? I mean, how was your first meeting with the rest of the band?
Well, it was 6 months of touring, first of all, before we did that first album together with Phil Collins for the first time. They were from very different backgrounds to me. They'd been at Charterhouse, so they had this sort of privileged background, and they were quite posh. Phil had already been a veteran of stage and screen. He'd acted in lots of things. He'd been in films. He was a child actor, he was a dancer, he was a singer. Even before he was a drummer, he was playing the part of the artful Dodger in Oliver, Lionel Bart's Oliver, in the West End. So he was more experienced, I think, than all of us as regards stagecraft and all of that kind of stuff. So it gives you an idea. We were from very different backgrounds. I was from the centre of London, and I wouldn't really call it a working class family, but my dad was very bright, and he was a very, very clever guy. He was able to play lots of musical instruments, and he was also good at a number of things, 20 different professions he could have had, some of which he explored. You know, he was up to professional cricket and football standard, and he could balance things on his nose. He could jump out of airplanes. He was a speed typist. I haven't finished here. He could make tables. He could paint pictures. And eventually, he left Shell. He worked for Shell, Mex, and BP. He was working with them for years. And then he started to make enough money selling his paintings at the same time when I turned professional musician with the Genesis gig. So we had lots of things in common, and it was a very busy household, what with him churning out paintings and me doing songs and albums. So it was a very productive time in the early 70s for us all.
And what was the sort of dynamics within the band themselves? I mean, Peter Gabriel, you know, you could argue this is Genesis' most fertile period. You've got Peter Gabriel, genius songwriter, somebody who described him as visionary, and some of his stagecraft was something else. Tony Banks, Mike Rutherford, superb musicians, and as you mentioned before, Phil Collins, veteran of stage and screen and a child actor before he came to you. So what was it like, you know, rehearsing, performing, and generally getting on with the rest of them? And did you know that you were creating great, you know, something that hadn't really been done before with those Genesis albums?
Well, I think Phil Collins was, he'd just joined just before I did, 3 months before. And, you know, he was a little bit like, I guess if you met him, you'd say, oh, professional Cockney, you know, cheeky chappy, all that.
Right.
And it was a persona that he was to exploit, you know, much more so in later life. But working with Mike, my late great friend John Wetton said, I've read Mike's book. He said, it must have been like working with the Duke of Edinburgh or something. And I love that line. And I said, yeah, you know, at times it was. I think what they would, the educational system that it was a so-called privileged situation that they'd undergone, they were brutalized by that and often forbidden to play music and forbidden to go to the local music shop and all that. So beatings ensued, some of them musical. What can I say? You know, I think they were designed to be the next Viceroy of India.
Mm.
You know, that's it. I mean, I don't know if you went to a public school yourself. I went to a grammar school, but a lot of guys say the same thing, you know, that there were harsh conditions and all that so-called privilege. But, you know, at least I had a family that I could, speak to. I didn't have to be stiff upper lip. So I think there was a lot of this repression, but I think it came out in the music and made it weird and wonderful and poetic and all the rest.
No, I did prep school and I did grammar school / independent as well. So I get where you're coming from.
Yeah, I think, you know, it must have been tough for you. I think all education in the 1950s, I think so much of it was abusive, masquerading as education. But I won't go into that. You know, that's a subject for many documentaries and films. And
exactly. Let's talk me through some of the process, though, the albums. I mean, you look at an album such as, you know, Nursery Crime, Lamb Lies Down on Broadway, selling them by the
yep.
pound. Did you, the songwriting process, did you all turn up with a bit, or did Peter swan in and go, I've got this lyric, or did Tony say, I've been working on this particular piece of wizardry? I mean, how did the actual process?
Well, every song varied, but I joined the band on the basis that I was a full-time member and a full-time writer with them. So we could all write, and so we contributed our bits. Sometimes someone would come in with a whole song and we would add to that. The songs tended to be very long at that time. In the main, Genesis albums in the early 70s comprised of three or four songs a side, and sometimes two songs on a side, like the Foxtrot in 72. Little short piece called Horizons that I wrote, which is 90 seconds long, then it gets into something that's 22 minutes long for the rest of the thing. So one long song, and everybody's competing, everybody's cooperating. Sometimes it would get pathologically competitive. Other times, when people dropped their guard and became their true valiant cooperative selves, it produced really top-class stuff. Other times there were disagreements, and sometimes it was a fight to the death. Have at you, sir.
I like that. Have at you,
handbags at dawn. What can I tell you?
I mean, you had to bring, and I'm not sort of blowing smoke up or whatever you use for thing, but you had to bring a certain amount of intelligence to a Genesis album. So whilst other rock gods were doing the rock god thing and you know, chalking off groupies on the bedpost or the back of the tour bus, I mean, a Genesis audience and a Genesis concert, I suppose it definitely wasn't one of those situations.
Well, let's put it this way. I think that I don't remember anyone throwing TVs out of the window.
Right.
Until I worked with some other people down the line. But, there was a famous story about, you know, Led Zeppelin trashed the room and The Who did that in the same hotel, blah, 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 blah. One of Genesis broke a teacup, and even he owned up at reception the following day. So we were known as, perhaps we were the Nancy Boys of rock in that way.
Are you going to just divulge which member of Genesis involved was that? No, reckless.
It was a joke by Chris Welch back in the days, like the idea of, you know, that they were, you know, Genesis were nice and polite and all of that. But I think if you saw us in private, you wouldn't think that so much. So I think that quietly people did subscribe to the excesses that that the other rock bands did, but it happened over a period of time. I think we were perhaps motivated more by the music than by the need to. I mean, we didn't have any members who died on drugs for a start, so it wasn't a proper rock and roll band. You understand?
Always helpful that I've heard that for you.
It's a great thing for a career if you can pop off by the time you're about 23. Your future is assured.
Exactly. The record companies would love that. What were your relationships like with other bands on the tour? Because, I mean, presumably bands like Yes, you would kind of get on with, because of that. Would you describe yourself, Genesis, as a prog rock band? I mean, did you think of yourself as prog rockers, or were you just a band getting on with it?
Nobody really used the term prog rock at the time. Progressive. If people said, oh, you know, progressive music, that really meant free-form jazz in the 1960s, and progressive, that the term was something that Richard Strauss used in the early 1900s, talking about Elgar. But nobody used prog until much later. So once the band had disbanded and reformed a few times, that was when, so it's a catch-all looking back, but we didn't think that. We just thought that we were another band trying to do music that was not blues-based, anything but. But there was this big emphasis on writing, and the songs had to be good, and or else you get put on a charge. You had to work hard at it, so, you know, songs might be driven by techniques or equipment, like I came up with this thing called tapping from 1971 onwards with Nursery Crime. I was doing this technique where you're using the fretboard of the guitar like a keyboard, so both hands are on the fretboard rather than one hand picking and the other moving around the notes. So I was doing that, and people were driven by different things. Getting a Mellotron was really important. For me, I knew that would transform the band's fortunes, and getting a light show. I was keen on us getting a Mellotron, a light show, and a synth, so that we could be cutting edge with the technology available at the time. Whereas the band that I joined was really, it was half acoustic.
Right.
It was almost like a concession doing some electric numbers. And people used to wander out. They would show up expectantly. Then they would wander off to the bar. And then we'd do a couple of rousing numbers at the end. And they would come back. And I think, oh, my God, we've got to change the emphasis here to try and retain their attention all the way through. And so, yeah, we had a few disagreements about that. Every band does.
Indeed. I mean, when it comes to, if you like, the classic albums, the two albums that, I mean, they're all great stuff, but Selling England by the Pound and The Lamb Lies Down on Broadway. I mean, that is an album. And I mean, I remember sort of, I would be early sort of teens or whatever, and the older cheat teens at school would have, you know, they'd bring it out as an LP, you know, and put it on in the common room or something. It was the album, The Lamb, and it was so dense and so, you know, then you just sit there in a blissful state. I mean, must have been, that sounds like it must have been an incredible experience to record.
It was, although it was tricky because Peter Gabriel, our lead singer at the time, said that he would stay for the album, and he would stay for the tour, but then he was going to leave after that. I think that he had an offer from William Friedkin, who directed The Exorcist, and Friedkin wanted Pete to write his next screenplay, and Pete said, "Yeah, okay, I'll do that." But what Friedkin hadn't realized was that that was virtually going to mean the breakup of the band. I think that Pete, perhaps more than anyone else, had the idea of having a solo career much earlier on, although ironically I ended up doing the first solo album myself. But he left in 75, and that year I did my first solo thing. But then we reconvened with Phil Collins on vocals. So the drummer came forward and was center stage with the mic, which is something that he'd been trained to do. You've got to realize, as I say, he was in Lionel Bart's Oliver, and so he knew how to carry a tune, and he was very, very good. I think, you know, to be able to hold the audience in the palm of your hand was something that Phil had, because he had the common touch. Whereas I think Pete's approach was perhaps a little bit more like Bowie, the sort of personifying the songs and living them and acting them out. So I think of Pete more like an actor, really, than a singer at that time. And the rest of us just used to sit around like the Pitt Orchestra, whilst he was the show visually, you know, dressing up in all sorts of things. And it was the thing that got us on front pages of magazines and was hugely important. So by the time everyone had their say and we'd been able to control the environment with our own show, as the show became more focused and as the keyboard arsenal grew, we were able to sound like an orchestra. We could give people like, talking about Lamb Lies Down on Broadway, people like Alice Cooper, we could give him a run for his money in terms of his theatrics and presentation and films and slides and various things. It was cutting edge. And I'm glad you said you liked Lamb Lies Down at the time, which was, you know, it was a great album and a very happy memory. But the previous album, Selling England by the Pound, John Lennon had picked up on the band and said Genesis was one of the bands he was listening to in 1973. So we were still at a kind of early stage of international touring, and we were in America when we heard that news, desperately trying to get a gig anywhere.
So it says something, doesn't it? I'm just thinking about some of the theatrics and Peter dressing up as a daffodil. That's the one that always springs to mind, isn't it?
Yeah, he dressed up as a flower or with a fox's head,
yeah.
Or wearing his wife's dress, or as the slipper man, covered in boils. And Yeah, it's
an interesting time, but it says something for Genesis, that the fact that, you know, Peter Gabriel leaves, Phil Collins comes to the fore, and the fans stay with him, because so many times when a band loses a lead man, 9 times out of 10, that's normally it for the band themselves.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, the influences ranged from pantomime to Prokofiev. There was a lot of different things that the band liked. Pete liked soul music and blues. He liked Otis Redding and Nina Simone. Phil liked big band stuff. Buddy Rich with Mel Tormé on vocals. That was his big thing. Mike Rutherford was more Judy Collins, Joni Mitchell. Tony was more church music and Vaughan Williams and Shostakovich. And I liked all of those things. And I also liked the idea of the mixture with atonal jazz and lyrical stuff, so that they would contrast. So it was a band full of writers, and sometimes that went smoothly. Other times it led to massive disagreements. But you know, when you've got 5 writers all trying to get hold of the pen or the key to the songwriting cabinet, you can imagine that it doesn't always the path of true love doesn't always run smooth.
True words indeed.
Or true music.
True words indeed. I mean, and the part of true music may run smooth. You decided at some point, you thought, well, my time in Genesis has come to an end. What sort of sparked that one off? And it must
I had, I did an album in 1975, and I had a hit with it, and I don't think anyone was expecting it to be a hit, least of all me. And so that created problems with the band. Sometimes it was the very people who'd helped me make the album were turning around and saying, "We don't feel as though you're giving everything to the band, Steve," you know, and they wanted me to forget about having a solo career in parallel. Meanwhile, I had various record companies breathing down my neck saying, "We want the next album, Steve." So I was, you know, I was between a rock and a hard place with that, and I thought, well, actually, if I step out on my own, I'll at least have autonomy. At least I'll be my own boss, the captain of my own ship, if I sink or swim. And so I worked with lots of really extraordinary people, some of whom Genesis had already been a fan of, such as the late, great Richie Havens. So I got to work with Richie. And so did Peter Gabriel some years later with his story of Ovo for the Millennium Dome. And I loved working with him. He was great, but he was just, you know, one of many. On the same album, I worked with Randy Crawford, who hadn't had anything released in this country, and then she became a huge star. Her singing was beautiful, and I think I was, after making the kind of album that was full of European chord changes, but with the sensibility of soul singers and American black, you know, blues stuff, with this kind of mixture, the sort of mixed race band that I had an idea of forming at that time. So that's what the album Please Don't Touch, a year after I left Genesis, that came out in 78. And I guess that's still going. People like Stephen Wilson say, you know, said for him when he was 11 years old, that was something that set him on a path of thinking about lots of different types of music. So I had an idea of doing a kind of songwriter's album, really, like or a bit like a sampler album, a bit like those The Rock Machine Loves You CBS albums,
right,
where it would sound like each track was done by a different artist, and in some cases it was. And so I guess that, you know, it was a very diverse album, and Tony Stratton Smith, the owner of Charisma Records, the record company at the time, said, well, it's both its strength and its vulnerability. It's his strength and its weakness, the fact that it's so diverse. So that's what happens when you try and do something that's got the influence of classical stuff and also all these other genres. But, you know, that idea of the pan-genre approach, producing work that borrows from many different styles, had to become a calling card for me. I mean, it's what attracted me to Genesis in the first place. So I've never really shaken off those roots, the idea of having work that's as varied as the Beatles were doing.
The book is called A Genesis in My Bed, Steve Hackett, the autobiography. It's out now on a Weimer publisher. For more information, you can find Steve on the internet. Thanks so much for your time today.